This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Sarah Dingle. Coming up, religious freedom versus Rugby Australia. Israel Folau set to go before a code of conduct hearing today over his anti-homosexual remarks on Instagram. After a year of turbulence, a new MD for the ABC, with David Anderson appointed managing director, and a meteor shower starts tonight, just in time for a big weekend for Star Wars fans.
Yes, today is May the 4th, so may the 4th be with you.
And you? Is that the right answer?
Yes.
Then man your ships, and may the Force be with you.
Yeah, so today is Star Wars Day.
Bill Shorten has narrowly been proclaimed victor of last night's leaders' debate by a TV studio audience of undecided voters. The Prime Minister and opposition leader went head-to-head in the second televised debate of the election campaign, this time in Brisbane. Everything from taxes to your local post office was up for discussion, and there were uncomfortable moments for both leaders. Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
Live from the Gabba in Brisbane, would you all please welcome Prime Minister Scott Morrison and opposition leader Bill Shorten.
This second showdown revealed not just a lot about the policies of Scott Morrison and Bill Shorten, but their personalities and how they respond to pressure.
Australia is the best country in the world, and I have a plan to keep it that way.
Australia needs a change.
The leaders covered a lot of ground in the Sky News debate, delving into the details of their plans to address climate change and return the budget to surplus. But several questioners also asked about mental health.
Do you guys have any intention of providing funding to Australia's 24/7 professional phone counselling service Kids Helpline?
The town hall format that Sky opted for is one Mr Shorten in particular knows well. It's his preferred option for engaging with voters on the road, and he's well practiced at trying to form a connection with the questioners.
Sorry, I should have asked, what was your first name?
Lana.
Oh, g'day, Lana.
He had a tougher time facing questions about planned changes to franking credits and the costings on Labor policies, which are yet to be released.
Hi, my name's Phil. My question's to Mr Shorten.
Thanks, Phil.
What number of policies does the Labor Party have in total at this stage, and what are the costings?
Big topic. The government say that we can't afford our policies. We have a different view. It's about priorities. In terms of our costings, we're going to release them towards the end of next week, the full box and dice. An hour here won't permit me to go through all of our policies and all of our costings.
There were more than 100 undecided voters in the audience, and 43% thought Bill Shorten won the debate. 41% gave it to Scott Morrison, and 16% weren't sure. The Prime Minister repeatedly pulled up Mr Shorten to question his figures and costs, but when the tables were turned, he also refused to detail how much would go to the highest income earners under the Coalition's planned personal income tax cuts.
OK, and but so what about for those earning more than $180,000 a year?
Yeah,
how much is going to them?
Do you want me to help there?
No, because I don't... I wouldn't trust your maths in a heartbeat,
Bill. Well, give us your maths on this, PM.
I've told you what the figure is. From 40,000 above, the figure is $96 million.
No, I'm asking for those over $180,000.
No, that hasn't been specifically set apart.
It was at this point that Scott Morrison left his own podium and began approaching Bill Shorten, and the opposition leader wasn't happy.
The other day, when you met a worker in Gladstone...
Where are you going?
And they were earning $250,000, and you sidled up to him, you're having a bit of a chat to him, and he complained about this, and what did you say to him? He said, oh, we'll have a look at that. You couldn't look him in the eye and tell him that you were going to increase his taxes by 2% on the 1st of July of this year.
You good there?
Yeah. I'm just wondering, can you look me in the eye and tell you're going to increase
classic,
the taxes?
You're a classic space invader.
Both leaders will remain in Brisbane this weekend, with Bill Shorten now looking towards Labor's official campaign launch there on Sunday.
Alexandra Beach reporting. And for more on how both leaders performed in last night's debate, Alexandra Beach spoke with Australian National University political marketing and campaigning expert Andrew Hughes.
I don't think there was a clear winner. I'd give it to Bill Shorten on points, but I wouldn't say it was a definitive victory at all. There were some times there where he struggled, and I think that we saw the personal evils of both leaders on display tonight at times.
You say personal evils both on display. Can you unpack that a little bit? What did you make of their performances?
Bill Shorten, the way he rolled his eyes or made facial expressions when he heard things he didn't like from Scott Morrison was quite worrying, because as the Prime Minister, you are going to hear a lot of things which you're not going to like. And, you know, if he wants to be the next Prime Minister of Australia, he can't do that. That can come across as being very smug, very arrogant and overconfident. And that could really hurt Labor in the later parts of the campaign. For Scott Morrison, his evil was at times borderline aggressive with his behaviour. He wasn't as shouty as he has been accused of being in the past, particularly the first debate. I think this time round he was a lot more measured with what he said and how he acted. But getting right up in front of Bill Shorten is not a good look at all. So I think at times he probably should have stood back a bit more and given Bill Shorten his time to speak without having sort of invading his personal space.
Bill Shorten came under pressure several times about his significant tax changes and the economy. He said that the costings are going to be out next week. But how do you think he went in terms of making the case there?
That was his biggest weakness in the debate tonight, was that he could not make his case on a number basis for his policy ideas, his tax cuts, and in particularly for climate change. And so that puts doubt in people's minds that there could be something there he's not being honest about. And that's going to play straight into the government narrative that there's risk in voting for Labor in a pure economic sense.
Now, this debate came on a Friday night. A lot of people have also already voted. The Electoral Commission, I think the last figure I saw for pre-poll votes was about, it's past the 500,000 mark. So
yes.
How much impact will this debate actually have in your mind?
No, I don't think too many people are watching. Perhaps people have had enough of hearing about the election talk. They've made their mind up already on their own way about their own issues, which are important to them. And we're seeing those numbers picked up in the pre-poll voting figures.
That's Dr. Andrew Hughes speaking with our political reporter, Alexandra Beach. Well, it's been an action-packed week in federal politics, and not in a good way, with scandal appearing to follow scandal. Six candidates have been disendorsed or sacked by their parties after sexist, violent, homophobic and anti-Muslim remarks surfaced. Rachel Mealy reports.
This week was a long time in politics.
It's the striptease that will stop a nation and shred this married politician's credibility at the worst possible time.
But the scandal didn't stop with those revelations about One Nation candidate Steve Dixon. By week's end, the Liberal and Labor parties had also snuffed out the flames of political hopefuls. Professor Graham Orr lectures in electoral law at the University of Queensland.
The electoral law is clear. Once someone's properly nominated by a party, that candidate remains on the ballot and they will sport that party label on the ballot. Pre-polling is already well underway, so it's too late to pulp the ballots.
In the seat of Lyons in Tasmania, the disendorsed Liberal candidate Jessica Whelan says she's still running for election as an independent. Professor Orr says name recognition will count for something when voters number the boxes.
You can remember Ms. Pauline Hanson got her break in Parliament 23 years ago through all of this. The Liberals disendorsed her for outrageous things said about Indigenous Australia, but she unexpectedly won because both staunch Liberal voters and some voters who sympathised with her voted for her.
The Women's Electoral Lobby says this week was a low point in Australian politics, with revelations of comments from candidates showing disrespectful and hateful attitudes towards women. Spokeswoman Josefa Sobsky says it points to a wider problem.
It reflects a broader societal attitude among some groups of men, which is not being addressed adequately.
She says the posts from Luke Creasy, the Labor candidate for the seat of Melbourne, were particularly concerning.
I look at this young man on the screen and he looks like such a clean-faced, lovely young man, but something wasn't right somewhere, because the stuff online is appalling.
Daniel Angus is an associate professor in digital communications at the Queensland University of Technology. He says political parties need to direct more resources to the vetting process.
Technically, it's not difficult. And for large political parties who have got, you know, plenty of resources to be doing this, I mean, you think about what they're spending on advertising, what they're doing around the place, it's not difficult to actually comb through someone's social media history and get a picture of who they are and what they're kind of doing and what their activity is.
He says the warning to young people that a social media footprint can follow you through life should extend to changes in the way the technology is used.
We've got to be really careful here about always seeking to blame the technology or claiming that a technology fix is the answer here. You know, it's not the technology itself that is causing people to be racist, to be homophobic, to be, assholes online. It's actually up to us as people to not be rude, to not hold other people in contempt. When we're online, it's not Facebook forcing us to be that.
Associate Professor Daniel Angus from the Queensland University of Technology. Well, rugby player Israel Folau will fight to save his playing career today when he goes before a code of conduct hearing over an Instagram post in which he claimed that hell awaits homosexuals and others he regards as sinners. In the wake of those remarks, the New South Wales Waratahs stood down Folau, who had already received a number of warnings for targeting the LGBTIQ community on social media. But Folau's case also raises issues of religious freedom, and legal experts are watching closely. Giuseppe Carabetta is a senior lecturer in employment law at the University of Sydney's Business School. He told Nick Grimm the case is anything but a straightforward workplace dispute.
Oh, it's a really interesting one because you've got conflicting human rights, if you like, here. Because on the one hand, and I won't weigh into whether I think it's right or wrong, but I mean, on the one hand, you have this suggestion that the post is homophobic and that it's offensive towards homosexual persons and others. And on the other hand, you know, the motivation for the post is said to be his religious background. So you've got this conflict there and how to try and balance that and whether the panel will get into that too.
Talk us through how this matter is going to be heard. The code of conduct hearing will be heard by a three-person panel, won't it?
Yeah, that's right. So it's a tripartite panel. So you've got a representative or a nominee from each side. So the union on the one side and Rugby Australia on the other side. And then you've got the neutral chairperson, and that's all set up by the code.
And how are they going to conduct the matter?
Well, that's a really interesting question because procedurally it appears to me that they have a fair amount of flexibility, as you would kind of expect with an internal panel such as this. But the big thing, I think the standout element is that the onus for establishing the breach is on the employer. So it's on Rugby Australia because they have brought the charge, if you like.
So what are the issues the panel are going to need to weigh then as you see them?
They will consider the degree to which his actions were intentional, as well as other things like whether there's been any offence to the general public's sensibilities, the way it might have impacted on the integrity of the code. They will look at the code. They will look at various other policies that are co-joined, if you like. And the big one is the inclusiveness policy. And the tricky thing for them is that it's really about stamping out homophobia. That's the focus of the policy. But it also, you know, says that there's not to be any discrimination or harassment or bullying of any kind within rugby. So you're then looking at obviously things like religious background. So weighing those two things up, again, the focus will be the argument by Rugby Australia that he's breached the code by firstly breaching the clauses that deal with social media use, and then secondly that in making the comment that he made in making that post, he's actually brought the game into disrepute because the post has, you know, this suggestion that it was homophobic.
Could there be questions that will need to be determined, though, that go beyond the jurisdiction of this hearing?
Well, potentially, yes. If he gets an outcome that goes against him, so if they uphold the decision or the recommendation to terminate the panel, he might pursue it externally. So we're looking at breach of contract issues, potentially, and also potentially a claim on the basis of religious discrimination. You know, they might try and look at it from a contractual perspective, or they might go to religious discrimination given the source or the motivation behind his post.
Senior lecturer in employment law at the University of Sydney Business School, Giuseppe Carabetta, speaking there to Nick Grimm. Well, after more than 6 months of uncertainty, the ABC has a new managing director. The chair, Ita Buttrose, has appointed David Anderson as the new MD of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Mr. Anderson has been acting in the role since September last year after Michelle Guthrie was sacked from the position. Media analysts say it's a good appointment, but he'll need to start communicating his vision for the public broadcaster sooner rather than later. Connie Aegis reports.
In a late-night announcement, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation announced David Anderson as its new managing director. Matt Peacock is a former ABC journalist and staff-elected director and now the convener of ABC alumni.
I think it's a very good appointment. It provides what the ABC needs at the moment, which Ita Buttrose, the new chair, signalled when she got the job, which is stability. He's a steady pair of hands, he's well-liked by staff, and he's proven that over the years he has a very firm knowledge of the place and a knowledge of what's needed in the new digital age.
David Anderson was appointed acting managing director in September last year after Michelle Guthrie was sacked halfway through her term. Matt Peacock says he's been good for the organisation at a time when it's struggling with funding.
It's had massive budget cuts. It's lost 1,000 staff or the equivalent, and that's a fifth of its workforce. But while he's been there, David Anderson has proven to be an adept lobbyist. He's been able to get a continuation of money for the regional journalism, what they call the enhanced news gathering package that was underway already but was running out. He got Scott Morrison to renew that. And so one hopes whichever government gets re-elected, he'll be able to continue that success because really the ABC is in dire straits at the moment. It doesn't have enough money even to do its primary job.
Matt Peacock says David Anderson has a good working relationship with ABC Chair Ita Buttrose.
Well, the very fact that he's been appointed shows that he's impressed Ita Buttrose as he impressed the board before this. I mean, he was number two on the list, basically, when the appointment of Michelle Guthrie took place. He's homegrown in the sense that he's spent many decades in the ABC, knows the place intimately, and actually knows the mechanism of the media, which is exactly what Ita Buttrose was looking for.
Margaret Simons is a journalist and currently writing a history of the ABC. She agrees that David Anderson has been a steady influence on the public broadcaster, but that he needs to start communicating his vision.
What we don't know is what his vision is for the ABC. We haven't yet heard from him on that, and how he plans to tackle the enormous challenges that it faces as a media organisation. Not all of these are challenges that are exclusive to the ABC. Declining audiences, particularly declining youth audiences, are a problem that virtually all media organisations are facing. But for the ABC, it needs to retain high levels of audience use and high levels of audience confidence in order to justify its position as a publicly funded broadcaster. And we have yet to hear from David Anderson about what his vision of the way forward might be.
David Anderson declined to be interviewed.
Connie Aegis. In India, a mammoth evacuation effort seems to have prevented countless deaths in the country's northeast. The most powerful cyclone in 5 years made landfall there yesterday afternoon, Australian time. More than 1 million people were evacuated, and so far, fewer than 10 deaths have been confirmed. South Asia correspondent Siobhan Heaney reports.
There were fears that Cyclone Fani could affect more than 20 million people and 10,000 villages along the northeastern coastline. After days of brewing in the Bay of Bengal, the Category 4 storm barreled into a coastal hamlet, bearing down upon fishing villages, farms and townships with winds gusting at up to 200 kilometres an hour. A similar storm here in 1999 killed 10,000 people, but some Indian states have drastically improved their disaster management planning since then. In a phenomenal feat of natural disaster preparedness, more than 1 million people were evacuated from the path of destruction in the hours before the storm hit. They ended up in centres like this one, where 2,000 people crammed into a small building. The man running the evacuation centre explained how they'll cook two meals a day for people who've turned up with no possessions.
Again, we'll come back for lunch also. So we are preparing for 2,000 persons. So we'll distribute among all the cyclone shelters.
Advances in technology and the ability to communicate widely to a huge amount of people helped the evacuation drive run smoothly. But it still required more than 60,000 police and other officials to encourage people to leave their homes. The government, which is in the middle of an election campaign, promised money for the affected states. Har sambhav sahayata. Railway Minister Piyush Goyal said the government was on standby to provide all possible aid. While the storm has been downgraded, it's expected to cross into Bangladesh, a country that routinely suffers from catastrophic flooding and storm surges during cyclone season. There, the evacuation effort will be even bigger, with the government saying it plans to evacuate more than 2 million people out of harm's way. This is Siobhan Heaneu in New Delhi, reporting for Saturday AM.
A Vietnamese woman has been released from a Malaysian jail, effectively closing the case on who was behind the murder of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korea's leader. Duan Thi Huang served less than 3 years in jail after her murder charge was dropped and she pleaded guilty to a lesser charge. The suspected masterminds, all North Koreans, escaped long ago and have never been brought to trial, as our Southeast Asia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
A large media pack followed Duan Thi Huang from the minute she was released from Kuala Lumpur's Kajang prison, smiling and clearly overjoyed.
Hi, Duan!
Barely a month ago, Duan still faced the prospect of the gallows if she'd been found guilty of murder. But with prosecutors agreeing to accept a guilty plea for a lesser charge and remissions for good behaviour, she was on a plane last night on her way home to Vietnam.
I thank you for all everybody pray for me.
Before taking off, she thanked people for her release.
Oh, I want to say I love you all. I thank you, my Lord Jesus. Thank you so much.
In Hanoi, her father and brother were waiting to meet her. She told reporters she didn't know what she wanted to do next, but said, I think I want to become an actress. Duan Thi Huang's release means there's now nobody in custody for the assassination of Kim Jong-nam. Seven North Korean men suspected of masterminding the plot have never been brought to trial. And Duan's co-accused, Siti Aisha from Indonesia, was freed without conviction last month after Indonesia lobbied Malaysian authorities for her release, an act her lawyer, Salim Bashir, agreed was unfair.
Well, that's an issue
because she was convicted, but on the same facts and premise the Indonesian woman was released, he said. Asked what it meant for Malaysia's legal system that a murder suspect could suddenly be released before trial, he said, that's a very peculiar situation because it's never happened before, where during the defence case a charge is withdrawn and she's completely acquitted. Huang's release effectively closes the case on one of the most brazen and bizarre assassinations in recent times. Malaysia has never officially accused North Korea and made it clear it didn't want the trial politicised. US and South Korean officials have no doubt the North Korean regime was behind Kim Jong-nam's murder because he'd been critical of the family's dynastic rule. But as others have said before, Malaysia clearly put diplomatic relations with Indonesia, Vietnam and North Korea ahead of justice for Kim Jong-nam.
Southeast Asia correspondent Anne Barker. A major international cybersecurity conference has closed in Prague with a warning. Compromising the world's future 5G mobile phone network could put at risk entire societies. The conference drew together top spies, diplomats and cyber officials from Europe, the US and Australia. Not invited to the conference were Russia and China, but the elephants in the room were politely ignored. Europe correspondent Linton Besser reports.
The company's chief financial officer has been detained in Canada. It's being prosecuted in the US for sanctions busting and bank fraud, and it's even been banned by Australia from helping to build the new 5G mobile phone network. The Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei is Lord Voldemort in this cybersecurity bedtime story, because even at this week's high-profile international 5G meeting of cyber spies in Prague, It was the name everyone seemed afraid to say out loud.
So having tried to align and reach a common understanding on the security requirements for 5G and the resilience requirements for 5G, we noted the problem of vendor diversity, but we didn't discuss it.
Did you catch that euphemism? One of the UK's top cyber officials, Kieran Martin, would only go so far as to note the problem of vendor diversity. Earlier, a senior Australian official, Greg Miller, referred only to a mysterious foreign government.
Government considers the involvement of vendors who are likely to be subject to extrajudicial directions from a foreign government that conflict with Australian law may risk failure by the carrier to adequately protect a 5G network from unauthorised access or interference.
The latest Huawei scandal to set the geeks and governments all a-twitter, the sacking of no less a figure than the minister overseeing the sixth most powerful military in the world. Gavin Williamson was dumped this week as the UK's defence secretary by Theresa May and accused of leaking National Security Committee plans to allow the Chinese telecom to play a role in the UK's 5G infrastructure. It was a bombshell leak because if implemented, it would spell a major rift in the Western Intelligence Alliance dubbed the Five Eyes. And the conference's key recommendations make plain the risk of influence on a supplier by a third country, which might not be party to international agreements on cybersecurity, cybercrime, and data protection.
These risks relate, of course, to the ever-expanding threat, the modus operandi of cyber criminals who are looking to infiltrate our systems and to steal our data, continue to evolve.
That's the EU Commissioner for Justice, Vera Jourova, who closed the Prague conference several hours ago.
In addition to attacks by criminals, we see increasingly the use of malicious cyber activities by state actors.
This is Linton Besser reporting for Saturday AM.
Well, today is May the 4th, also known as Star Wars Day for fans around the world, to whom I say, May the 4th be with you. Many will also be marking the recent death of actor Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca for almost 40 years. And tonight is also the start of a spectacular meteor shower known as the Eta Aquarids. Our reporter Eliza Borello headed to Perth Observatory.
The Perth Observatory is about a 40-minute drive east of Perth City into the hills. I've gone past some horse studs and some wineries to get here, and it's fair to say it's a hive of activity today. I'm here with Matthew Woods, one of the volunteers and an amateur astronomer. Matt, can you tell me why there's such a buzz around the place this weekend?
Yeah, so this weekend is pretty full on with astronomical events. We've got the Eta Aquarids coming up on Monday morning, and they're actually one of the meteor showers that are caused by Comet Halley, the other being the Orionids later on in the year. And they're actually quite good to have a look at if you can find a dark place to look at.
What will people see if they're up early enough?
Well, good news is we don't have a moon in the night sky during the peak, which is Monday morning, and so you should get to see about 10 to 20 meteors per hour if you get up around about 4 a.m.
Now, I think we need to cue some theme music for you to explain the other reason that there's a bit of a buzz around the place today. Can you tell me, Matthew, why that is?
Yes, today is May the 4th, so may the 4th be with you.
And you? Is that the right answer?
Yes.
Then man your ships, and may the 4th be with you.
Yeah, so today is Star Wars Day, and so this is where all Star Wars nerds get celebrate the Star Wars.
Obi-Wan, may the 4th be with you. Goodbye, old friend. May the 4th be with you.
And tomorrow is Revenge of the Fifth, so they're trying to get that as well as another Star Wars Day. But, yeah, we're going to have a special Star Wars night, so we'll have the 501st and Rebel Alliance costumers up here, so we'll try and keep them apart so they won't destroy the observatory. But kids and family who come up for our sold-out night sky tour for tonight can actually go and get photos with them, and we'll have the place decorated.
Thank you, Matthew. Now, Julie Matthews, another volunteer, is also here. Julie, can you explain to me why this year's May the 4th Be With You weekend is particularly special?
Well, there's one reason. It's a bit poignant. Yes, that's it's a really sad loss of the man who played Chewbacca yesterday. So I'm doing up a little dummy, just a little ode to Chewbacca for everyone to enjoy.
All right, well, I think I'll let you guys do the honours with the saying of the day.
May the fourth be with you.
That is Chewbacca and volunteers from the Perth Observatory ending Eliza Borello's report. That's Saturday AM for today. I'm Sarah Dingle. Thanks for your company.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.